For example, in St. Petersburg, a city of about 1 million people, only 7,000 people were allowed even to vote based on property and status. Finally, Alexander III engaged in an intensive process of Russification and discrimination against national minorities all throughout the country. In Finland, in Poland, in Ukraine, all of which had movements for national independence and liberal reform, there was an attempt to impose Russianness much more intensely. Russian language was now mandatory in all schools and had to be used in all local institutions, and native languages were treated at best as second languages. Most notoriously, stringent laws were passed against Jews, seen as being unrooted from any national identity, not truly part of Russia, more likely to be cosmopolitan and liberal, and therefore dangerous. Quotas were set on the number of Jews who could be in secondary schools or universities, especially those in the center of Russia, but even in the areas where Jews were most numerous. Jews were limited to certain professions and occupations. And above all, Jews were more intensely than ever before restricted as to where they could live, basically only in the Pale of Settlement, the areas around Poland especially, and only in towns and cities, keep them away from the peasants. The government tended, according to historians who have researched this more recently, tended to pretty clearly look away whenever pogroms broke out, these violent attacks on Jews that were especially common in 1881, but in later years as well. And in fact, there's some evidence that local authorities even encouraged attacks on Jews. In fact, Alexander III's attitude toward Jews, not unlike his attitude to other minorities, but Jews were particularly troublesome, he thought, was typical of many elite Russians in government circles at the time. As he said at one point, he said, "In the depth of my heart, I am always really happy when they beat the Jews. Still, we must not allow it." He was, of course, first attached to the need for order in society. Now, when one looks closely at Alexander III, we see that order, control, was something he valued, but in fact it went still deeper than that. In many ways, Alexander III and those around him were engaged in really what might be described as a rather radical project, namely trying to save Russia from disorder by turning the clock back, by turning the face away from where Peter the Great and Catherine and so many of his predecessors had turned it toward greater westernization. And one sees this turn away from the West in all sorts of telling ways. For one, one sees it just in his visual appearance alone. While he was still heir to the throne, while he was serving in the army as an officer, he decided, and it was partly because a special law had been passed allowing this for soldiers only, to grow a large beard. And he kept this beard, though, all his life. In fact, for the first time, once he came to the throne in 1881, for the first time since Peter the Great, a monarch of Russia wore a beard. And we know what a symbol that was for Peter, who personally cut them off everyone at court. Similarly, he redesigned soldiers' uniforms to make them more traditional, more Muscovite, before the German styles, before the French styles that had been favored in all the years since Peter's time. Personally, he also adopted what was described by some as a virile national appearance. Now, partly this came natural to him. He was a big man physically, a very muscular man. And in his dress, he favored what many people described as a masculine Russian style. He liked military uniforms, especially redesigned ones that looked less European. Big jackboots, a large Russian cap. He also loved physical activity. He liked to personally chop wood on his own palace grounds. He liked to break ice in the little canals near his palace as winter was coming to an end. He felt in all of this, a true Russian man, a man who exuded confidence and strength and Russianness. Another symbolically important way that Alexander tried to recall Russia's ancient traditions, to turn Russia's face back away from Europe, was a church he had built in 1883 on the spot where his father was blown up by a terrorist's bomb. And in the very midst of neoclassical and to some extent Baroque St. Petersburg, the very symbol of Russia's turn to the West, Alexander chose as a design for this church, which would be called the Church of the Resurrection of Christ on the Spilt Blood, the blood being that of his father. He chose a design that was intensely old-fashioned, intensely Muscovite, a very elaborate version of a 17th century church. Varied patterns and colors in its flamboyant canopy, and on the outer walls, multicolored decorations and tile work, an exaggerated neo-Muscovite building. In fact, one Petersburg art critic, once he saw this thing going up, declared that this Muscovite church in neoclassical St. Petersburg created, as he put it, a troubling dissonance in the architecture of the city. And one might say that this was exactly the point in choosing this design. This was an aesthetic rebuke to the very city of St. Petersburg and all it stood for. It was a challenge to this faith in the political culture of the West, of rationality and progress. And in fact, similar what were called neo-Russian churches tended to be built in later years in other places in Russia as well. Now, Alexander's turn to the past was visible not just in these superficials, in his dress and in his style of architectural choice. It was explicitly visible in his political beliefs as well. He made it clear again and again that he believed deeply in the most traditional notions of autocratic, absolute, monarchical, divine power in Russia. He repeatedly made it clear that the free will of the state, indeed, better to say, of the monarch himself, was more important than that of any law or any institution. The temporary regulations, which I mentioned, were a very good sign of this. They allowed the Tsar, for example, to appoint governors of any province with extraordinary, it was called, discretionary power, and gave officials a virtually free hand to imprison and jail and exile citizens without recourse to the law. In fact, there's a telling anecdote at the time describing Alexander III's policies here of reasserting the traditional absolutism of the monarchy. On one occasion, in a private meeting, it should be said, or they would have been in exile if this was a public meeting, Alexander's minister of war was having a chat with a friend of his and said Alexander III reminded him a lot of Peter the Great with his club going around and using great force to get his way. And as Fred said, no, I think you're only half right there. Alexander was the club without the great Peter. Without, in other words, the vision, the greatness, nothing but stubborn force itself. A somewhat more generous reading was offered by Alexander's minister of finance, a man named Sergei Vita, who described Alexander as a mountain of stone, firm and reliable and imposing, needless to say, immovable and unmoving. He was, in other words, a classic Grozny Tsar, all-powerful, mighty. At the same time, he tried to be a Tishaishi Tsar, this also part of the Russian tradition, a pious, loving ruler. Religious faith was central to his understanding of what it meant to be Russian, what it meant to be a Tsar. And he tried to promote this true faith as central to what he thought the state should be doing. More importantly, he believed absolutely and unquestioningly in his divine appointment. His absolute power could be justified in part by the fact that he was divinely chosen and caring for his people. Hence some of his reforms that were meant to improve the life for peasants, the true Russian people. Observers unanimously described Alexander as exuding calm, imperturbable confidence, a mountain of stone, as it were. But there's reason to think that underneath all this, perhaps for Alexander, certainly for many in his circle, there was a great deal of doubt. This wasn't just confident certainty that led to such conservatism. There was also something that might just be described as fear and anxiety and even foreboding about the dangers of change. One sign of this was a rather remarkable turn away from public life in ruling circles. It seemed increasingly that those people with power in Russia showed less and less interest in public civic affairs. They seemed to find these things increasingly distasteful. In court circles, for example, it was noticed an enormous upsurge in the number of lavish balls and receptions and banquets. For example, the Court Journal of 1884 listed 8 huge balls in St. Petersburg alone just in the high season of January and February. And there were many other smaller gatherings. And by the way, it wasn't unusual for one of these great balls, especially if held in the Winter Palace, to be attended by 8,000 highly elite guests. In general, private socializing seemed to increasingly replace concern with public affairs. As one aristocratic woman said at the time, society danced more and criticized less. Politics simply ceased to interest the public. The Tsar himself, in fact, seemed to in many ways retreat from public political life whenever possible. Family life began to assume a sort of sacred character for Alexander, a happier realm apart from the state. And in fact, he seemed to prefer more and more time at his country house where he could relax and hunt and go boating and take long walks and chop wood and play with his children. An even more telling indication, though, of the anxieties and the doubts that underlay Alexander III's policy can be found by looking at his closest advisor, a man named Konstantin Pobedonostsev, who lived from 1827 till 1907. In a lot of ways, Pobedonostsev was really probably the most powerful and influential intellectual in Russia during the final decades of Tsarist rule. From 1880 to 1905, he held the post as what was called chief procurator of the Holy Synod. This meant he was the layman, he was not a priest, who was in charge of administering the Russian Orthodox Church. And this meant he had power over education, because the church controlled many of the schools in the country and set rules for others. It also meant he had control in a certain sense over ideas, at least the church's effort to spread ideas over culture as well. But he also had very direct influence over the thinking of Russia's last two rulers. He was chosen to be the tutor of Alexander III, and then Alexander III again chose him to be the tutor for his own son, Nicholas II, both before they inherited the thrones. And he remained a close personal advisor to both rulers until his death. He was enormously influential. For example, in 1881, Pobedonostsev almost single-handedly convinced Alexander III to reject the reforms of Larys Melikov. Initially, Alexander III was unsure. After all, his father had signed it, after all. Pobedonostsev convinced him how dangerous this would be. And in 1895, when the new Tsar, Nicholas II, came to the throne, he would similarly convince the Tsar to make his first public statement, one declaring his rejection of any form of representative government, even consultative. Now, Pobedonostsev's thinking about politics is fairly straightforward. In fact, one might say rather blunt and harsh. He opposed any constitutional or legal limitation on the power of the monarch whatsoever. He saw these as counter to Russian traditions, and counter, most importantly, to the nature, the true nature of the Russian people. We've seen this in the ideas of official nationality before. And the tone with which he condemned constitutionalism is revealing as the fact itself. For example, quite early in 1879, he wrote to his student, Alexander III, before he came to the throne, the following about people who spoke about the usefulness of liberal reform in Russia. He writes, Pobedonostsev, he says, "What I hear from highly placed people of different stations and ranks makes me sick. It's as if I were in the company of half-wits or perverted apes. Everywhere I hear that trite, deceitful, accursed word, constitution." And he concluded remarkably. He declared, "A Russian revolution, an ugly upheaval, is preferable to a constitution, because the former, a revolution, could be suppressed, order restored throughout the land, but the latter is poison to the entire organism." And Pobedonostsev's conservatism was not only shrill in tone, it was very extreme in content. For example, in 1881, when Alexander III first came to power, he shocked many ministers when he made a speech before the whole gathered cabinet in the Winter Palace, in which he condemned almost all the reforms of Alexander II. He blamed courts and lawyers for crime and murder, said there wouldn't be so much if it weren't for the courts and the lawyers. He denounced all forms of representative local governments, zemstvos, city government. He even denounced what little bit of freedom of the press was left, of course, at the end of the reign of Alexander II. Most ministers were aghast even the relatively liberal war minister, a man named Dmitry Milyutin, declared that Pobedonosov's talk before them on that moment was, in his words, a negation of all that is the foundation of European civilization. And it's worth saying he was not entirely off base. Philosophically, Pobedonosov did reject the very central ideas of the European Enlightenment, namely faith in human reason. For Pobedonosov, like European conservatives as well, the most dangerous idea in the world was the idea that human beings, and by extension society, was perfectible. Or the idea at its heart, even worse, that human beings were endowed with reason, and with reason they could improve the world. For Pobedonosov, Russia must rely not on reason, artificial reason, which was not what it was cracked up to be by philosophers of the Enlightenment, but only on sacred and unquestioned forms of authority rooted in tradition. More, though, than philosophy was behind these conservative ideas, there was something else, I think, visible and increasingly common in conservative thought in Russia toward the end of the old regime, and certainly in Pobedonosov thought, and that was a deep fear of modernity, a fear of people, a fear about where the world was heading. Partly for Pobedonosov, this was a matter of personality. People who knew Pobedonosov were struck by his deep pessimism, his misanthropy in looking at life. As an illustration, here is one of his diary entries. This was from New Year's of 1875. He wrote, "Why rejoice when another drop has disappeared from the cup of life, and one can hear a deep echo from the dark chasm in which it fell?" He did have some pleasures as a person. He liked to write very gloomy verses about twilight and dusk. He adored the Orthodox liturgy. Above all, he would tell people, because of its majestic and moving evocations of Christ's suffering. And he particularly liked funerals and wrote enthusiastically in his diary about how beautiful and moving they were. And in some ways, he wanted others to feel and live the way he did. He suggested at one point that dances ought to be banned from Russia, balls, fancy banquets, which, as you know, were proliferating. And this misanthropy wasn't just personal, I should say, it was also philosophical. Like most 19th century conservatives, though one might suggest with a particular Russian intensity, he had an extremely dismal view of humanity. This was more than just a simple denial of the primacy of reason. He considered man to be, by nature, weak, vicious, these are his words, weak, vicious, worthless, and rebellious. And in fact, at one point he expressed absolute amazement that human beings had managed to even survive as long as they had, given how terrible they were. You can see this man is the total opposite in his worldview of Tolstoy, and it's worth remembering that it is Pobedonosov, as head of the Orthodox Church, that had Tolstoy excommunicated. I should add that in addition to these general flaws that all human beings shared, he noticed that Russians had some extra flaws. They were inert, lazy, dishonest, greedy, power-hungry, and, of course, drunken, though he admitted they were also very friendly and good-natured. In the face of these convictions about human nature, he looked at the future and saw only misery and error. In his words, from a letter elaborating on the famous phrase from Ecclesiastes, a book he loved, he wrote, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. All fades, all vanishes, all disintegrates, all deceives." And against this background, Pobedonosov saw only three institutions that could save Russia: the family, the Orthodox Church, and the state. You can see here a version of the traditional idea of official nationality, or orthodoxy, autocracy, and the uniqueness of the Russian people, nationality. The family, for Pobedonosov, had the job of repressing the evil instincts in the child, just the opposite of Tolstoy's idea of education. The family must teach obedience, and he had the church instruct parents to do just that. Stifle children's imagination. It's a very dangerous thing, he said. Stifle their love of learning. It leads them in dangerous ways. What you need were skills, not critical ways of thinking. The church, of course, also had to teach all of its parishioners obedience, and he was the head of the church remember. It also was to provide that spiritual and ideological cement that would hold society together, that would hold these weak people together and create some stability. But of greatest importance for Pobedonosov, especially in Russia, was the autocratic state, the very embodiment of this truth in his mind that human beings, that men, not laws, must rule. Ideally, this was to be a rule of a patriarchal nature. The Tsar should be not only absolute, but wise and moral and loving, and of course, advised by wise men like himself. And the people, of course, were expected to respond like ideal children with love and unquestioning obedience. Now, Pobedonosov was a very smart man. He admitted that as a result of all these human frailties, the autocratic system was never as perfect as he wished it were. But every other conceivable political system, he argued, was worse. Most of all, he feared democracy, because what does democracy do above all but give free rein to man's worst instincts, to their reason? Clearly, then, this was not a confident ideology. It emerged from a faith and tradition. It had gotten Russia so far, after all. But it also emerged from a sort of emotional and philosophical fear and loathing, a fear about the future, especially a modern future with greater freedom and liberty for individuals, and, of course, a loathing for human nature itself. In many ways, these were the ideas and sentiments that would inspire the autocracy to its very end. And one could even argue these were the ideas in the hands of powerful people like Pobedonosov and of rulers like Alexander III and then Nicholas II that were bringing that end all the closer. Next time, we'll look at Alexander's son, Nicholas II, who presided over that final end, at his ideals and idealism about power and about Russia, about his faith and his fears.
Lecture 19, Nicholas II, the Last Tsar.
The subject of this lecture is the last Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II, who ruled from 1894 until 1917. In many ways, it's actually difficult to talk honestly and fairly about Nicholas II. First of all, as a ruler who failed, or at least whose rule ended with the collapse of the whole political system over which he presided, he's often been treated as, in history, as weak, even stupid, as more attentive to his family and his country, and as simply the wrong man to rule Russia at such a critical time. As a ruler whose policies included a great deal of brutal repression, including intensified censorships, political arrests, exile to Siberia, he's often also been treated by historians and by many Russians as a narrow-minded tyrant trying to hold on to power in an age of social modernization and rising democracy in Russia as all over the world. In other words, he's been treated as what many contemporaries called him, Nicholas the Bloody. Also, though, as a man who, along with his wife and five children and several servants, was brutally executed in 1918 by revolutionaries in the middle of the night in the basement of a Siberian house where he was held prisoner, and their bodies hidden in secret graves only to be found in recent years. As such, Nicholas has also been treated often as a tragic figure, as an innocent martyr, as a saint, or at the very least, as a symbol, a moral symbol of the evil of communism. What I'd like to do is try to avoid these simplifications and clichés, though they all have some merit of truth. My goal is not to try to judge Nicholas. I don't think actually that's the call of the historian, but to try to understand Nicholas on his own terms, to grasp his own ways of thinking and, one might say, feeling about life and about politics. One needs to begin with how Nicholas and many Russians thought about Russia's political traditions and needs, what it is he felt he had inherited, what traditions and approaches he felt were proper and true to Russia's history and needs. And when Nicholas thought about what sort of ruler he should be, and I should say he did think about it, despite stories that he was not interested in thinking about the serious questions of rule, when he did think about this, he drew on two large political cultural traditions that I think by now will already be familiar to you. The first of those was the tradition of the Tsar, of the emperor, as absolute in authority, advancing Russia's interests with might and force. In other words, the idea of what's called in Russian of the Grozny Tsar, awesome in his power and might, fierce, powerful. But there's also a second mythic ideal, as we've seen, a second ideal about what a true and proper monarch should be in Russia, and that's the image of the ruler as a sacred figure, as a divine figure, as a Christian ruler, seeking unity with his people, a special bond, being loving, conciliatory. This was the image, the ideal, called in Russian, that of the Tishaishi Tsar, literally the most gentle Tsar, pious, saintly, loving. And the popular term for this, increasingly often heard during the reign of Nicholas II, was the ideal of the Tsar Father, Tsar Batushka. In many ways, Nicholas II, like his father, Alexander III, embraced strongly this Grozny ideal of the ruler as a bulwark of order and tradition and power. Personally, Nicholas was absolutely obsessed with order and regularity and discipline. His diary is an interesting documentary account of this ideal. Now, typically, when people talk about Nicholas's diary, they cite it as evidence of how stupid he was, how intellectually shallow he was. And in fact, when you read it, what you find are long lists of the rather trivial details of his day, without much reflection or ideas. Discussion of reports and meals and walks and who he received and hunting and time spent with family and what books he read and the like. Just as an example, here's an entry from February 15th, 1913, though I could pick almost any, they all are very similar. Read in the morning. Received reports from Mamontov, Bieckendorf, and Count Gaiden, all military officers. Walked for 1/4 hour. Received Kokovtsev, this was the prime minister. And at 12:30 went to the Great Palace, where I received the Emir of Bukhara and ate breakfast with him. Went home at 2 p.m. Skied with my daughters for a long time. Grigori, which is Rasputin, came and spent more than an hour with us. At 6, I received Maklakov, that's the Ministry of Interior Affairs. In the evening, I worked and then read aloud to the family. What he discussed at all of these important meetings, what his thoughts were, he doesn't tell us at all. But the important thing to emphasize is that this diary was never meant by him to be a medium for reflecting or talking about ideas. The diary was, and he was taught to write this such a sort of a diary, an exercise in self-discipline, an orderly record of an orderly existence. In general, we know that as a person, both public and private, Nicholas tried to imbue his life with discipline, self-discipline, orderliness, systematization, with order in everything. For example, perhaps trivial, but I think telling, Nicholas II tried to maintain a work schedule that was fairly rigid and unvarying. A regular schedule of meals and reading reports and meeting with officials and physical exercise and time with his family, all as much as possible by the clock. In a similar spirit of personal order in his life, Nicholas insisted on doing all his own secretarial work. He liked to keep his papers, like his life, in order himself. Even the smallest details of his life, according to those people who knew him, were a perfect example of the concern with personal discipline in order. As one of his close friends, a lady in waiting to his wife, a woman named Anna Vyrobova, put it, Nicholas was the tidiest, most systematic of men. According to her, he kept every pen and pencil on his desk in perfect straight lines. Even his bathroom was in perfect order, and he made sure of this himself. Now, one sees this same love of order in more substantial areas, in particular, his attraction to military culture. Now, I probably don't need to remind you of how central everything about the military was to the Russian political tradition, and especially to the image of the ruler as Grozny, as a mighty and awesome ruler. And in part, the centrality of the military to Russian politics is obvious, is true in the obvious sense. The military was the central instrument and sign of Russian autocracy's power and might at home and in the world. But in more subtle ways, and I think ways that were important to Nicholas II, the military was also an expression of cultural values, one might even say of ethics. It was a symbol of individuals, for all their chaos and diversity, made orderly, rational, disciplined, controlled. Just look at marching troops, and one can see this achievement. Later, as Russia's ruler, Nicholas made it clear that he loved to be among soldiers, and, by the way, in uniform. In fact, he and his son and his wife and daughters were honorary commanders of a whole variety of elite regiments. They were given uniforms by each of these regiments, specially tailored to fit them. In fact, they had whole closets full of honorary uniforms, and they loved being in them, especially Nicholas did. He often included this in his letters and diaries. And he also loved spending time, and he spent a great deal of time, at military reviews and ceremonies and inspections and observing maneuvers. It's clear that these times with the military had great personal meaning for him. For example, in his letters home, which he wrote extensively to his wife, Alexandra, he constantly remarked on how beautiful, his word, military dress was, on the beauty of military ceremony and practice. In fact, to give one more specific example, while observing some very large army maneuvers near the town of Kursk in 1902, he wrote to his wife, Alexandra, and by the way, I should say these quotations are not translations. Nicholas wrote almost entirely to his wife in English, since his wife, Alexandra, was Queen Victoria's granddaughter and had an English education. Nicholas knew English well as well. When observing these maneuvers in Kursk, he wrote and expressed that he was sorry she couldn't be there with him, that he really wished that she could be there to enjoy what he called the good, healthy feelings and sense of inner calm that he was enjoying being with the army. And there are many letters like this. And pay attention to this particular and really very important political psychology. Calm and pleasure through the rituals of tradition and order and discipline and, of course, military might. This was all part of that one side of Russia's political, cultural tradition, the ideal of the Grozny Tsar, which Nicholas completely embraced. Now, to be sure, all of this can be seen as simply matters of personality, but they were also personal values and, by extension, shaped his ideas about fundamental questions of society and politics. These values, personal though they seem to be, but rooted in a political tradition, helped shape policy in Russia. Simply put, in all areas of life, he believed, all people, whether at work or in their relations with other people, should be guided by the very same virtues. They should live a life marked by order and self-discipline and regularity. And of course, he believed strongly that the autocratic state was the key to making sure that everybody in all areas of life lived in just this stable way. For him, this was a matter of virtue. And we see these same ideas in the very concrete realm of policy. For example, in his persistent rejection of talk about political freedom and democracy. To him, these were matters of disorder, as they were for his tutor, of course, Konstantin Pobedonostsev. For example, when he came to the throne in 1896, his formal coronation, he made his first public address, probably written for him, by the way, by Pobedonostsev himself, who we talked about last time. And he, in this speech, with representatives of society gathered before him, he spoke about widespread talk in society about a constitution as, in his words, nothing but senseless dreams. Shocking many how brutal he was in rejecting these as something not even worth dreaming about. Later, when the country erupted in revolution in 1905, when those senseless dreams of democracy became for Nicholas in some ways a nightmare, and this is a story I will tell next time, he agreed to create, under a great deal of pressure, a legislature and to grant civil rights. Within a couple of years, though, he began to regret his weakness at that moment. And he did everything he could to undo those policies, which we'll describe next time, of granting some measure of constitutional power to people and some measure of civil rights. He rewrote the electoral laws to ensure that disloyal groups were less visible in the Duma, the legislative body that was created by the revolution, workers and people from the cities. He limited the power of the legislature over all aspects of society. Especially their power over the military. And above all, he reserved for the government the right, often exercised, to abrogate civil rights, protect internal security, whenever he felt necessary. In every respect, he believed in the importance of the power of autocracy and using it to preserve order. In fact, his personal reactions to disorder, in particular the strikes and demonstrations that began commonly in Russia from the 1890s, are revealing. This is particularly evident in his response to the revolution of 1905, the history of which I'll describe next time. But listen to his reaction to it. He says, "It makes me sick to read the news. Nothing but strikes in schools and factories, murdered policemen and Cossacks and soldiers, riots, disorder, mutinies everywhere." He said what's needed is quick decision, ruthless action, a strong and steady hand. No less telling are that in his many statements about the disorder of public protests, he declared that it was really more even a disgrace and a shame that such disorder should exist than it was a political threat. He seemed more concerned by the moral harm, the moral shame of such actions in his society than by what a threat they really posed to him. Now, of course, there's another side to Russia's and Nicholas II's political culture. And this is the idea that you've heard about before, well established in Russian tradition, the idea of the Tsar as Tishaishi, as a ruler united in love and harmony with his devoted people, as saintly, as pious, as the Tsar father, Tsar Batyushka. And in fact, Nicholas II also devoted a great deal of effort to publicly expressing this ideal. And he found in these public rituals of his bonds with the people confirmation of his faith. They too were deeply meaningful to him. For example, in 1900, Nicholas started a new tradition of regularly celebrating Easter, Easter being the highest holiday on the Russian Orthodox calendar, celebrating Easter in Moscow, the ancient heart of old Russia, and in the Kremlin itself, in the most ancient churches and cathedrals. And here, he said, especially in Moscow and especially on Easter, he could enter into communion with the Russian people, with, and these are his words, with the true children of our beloved church. And in unity, in prayer with my people, I can draw a new strength for serving Russia. Or another example, in the fall of 1902, in a letter written back home to his wife, Alexandra, who was often ailing, hence rarely traveled with him, hence where we have this wonderful body of letters between the two of them. In 1902, Nicholas wrote of driving through the countryside in a troika, a cart pulled by three horses, a very traditional sort of vehicle in Russia, and he's on his way to some military maneuvers. He was often on his way to military maneuvers. And he writes the following in his letter home. "We passed through large villages where the good peasants presented simple bread and salt, and all went down on their knees, showing such a touching, childish joy. Like many before him, he believed that the people were like children who loved him in a unique and special way." Or consider his attitudes during the celebrations of the tercentenary, the 300th anniversary of the existence of the Romanov dynasty, celebrated all over the country in 1913. During these celebrations, Nicholas decided to take a grand tour throughout the Russian heartland, the old core of Muscovite Russia, the Moscow regions and the Volga regions. And huge crowds came out to greet him while he traveled about the country, often in a boat. Many would in fact wade and swim into the rivers to touch his boat. while he sailed down the Volga or the Moscow rivers. Nicholas was totally overwhelmed, totally and deeply impressed by what he described as the people's love of autocracy. So much, in fact, was he impressed by these signs of great devotion to him personally, that after this trip, which was in the wake of course, the 1905 revolution and some of the initial democratic reforms that were passed then, that he suggested, I think it's time to close the parliament altogether, which he never liked anyway, close it entirely. What need was there, he argued, for this artificial, mediated link to the common people? His connection to the people was immediate and direct, almost mystical. Who needs a parliament? He knew what the people needed and believed. Saner minds advised him that this would lead to a catastrophe if he closed the parliament. Or as another example of his self-image, and indeed many people shared in the self-image of him, this image of him as a Tishaishi, loving Tsar, as Tsar father, consider his response to the massive demonstrations that took place on Palace Square, right outside the Winter Palace, at the very start of World War I in August of 1914. He comes out onto the balcony, a huge crowd he sees on the street, on the square before him, and standing beside his wife, Alexandra. And at this point, he does a very interesting thing. He bows his head to the crowd. This is a traditional gesture of devotion of Tsar to the people, used throughout the 19th century, actually much older and then revived in the 19th century. This was the classic gesture of the Tishaishi Tsar. The mass of the people, in response to his bowing to them, fall down on their knees and sing the Russian national anthem, the words of which begin, God save the Tsar, strong and mighty. Bozhe Tsarya Hrani. Nicholas and Alexandra reportedly wept at this moment. Tears of faith, one might say, in this special bond between Tsar and people. It was in a similar spirit and with similar faith that during World War I, Alexandra, his wife, and Nicholas's elder daughters, Olga and Tatiana, decided to serve as nurses, literally sisters of mercy, in the war, personally caring for wounded soldiers, part of this special bond between the Tsar's family and the people. And it was in a similar spirit and with a similar faith in this special bond between Tsar and people that Nicholas took over complete command of the army in 1915, at a time the war was going very badly for Russia. And he was certain that his charismatic presence, that his very body, his very presence as this divine autocrat with this special bond to the people would transform the whole success of the military effort. Just like you recall, Nicholas I was able to, he believed, quell riots by his presence alone. Religion, of course, was central to this whole faith. Nicholas believed, of course, deeply in the divine sources of his authority. In fact, he was completely certain that God spoke and acted through him, quite literally spoke and acted through him. As he liked to say in interviews, he said, I never prepare what I'm going to say in audience, but praying to the Lord God, I then speak what comes into my mind, implying God put the words there. Indeed, many important political decisions in the course of his reign were decided above all and sometimes only in consultation with this divine voice he believed he could hear through his own thoughts, ignoring sometimes quite dangerously the advice of his ministers, who had no such special bond, and certainly of educated public opinion. At a more personal level as well, Nicholas found great and increasing comfort in religious practice and religious faith. He spent increasing amounts of time visiting church, praying even outside of church. And in fact, he didn't limit himself just to the formal practice of orthodoxy. And this is something new and interesting that hasn't been seen really since Alexander I's explorations of religion. Together with his wife, Alexandra, who, one should remember, converted to orthodoxy from Lutheranism, Nicholas read, along with other members of their court circle, a variety of religious literatures, both Western, not just Orthodox, and Eastern as well. In fact, he was fascinated with Eastern religions and Eastern cultures. He was a very big collector of art objects from the East, all of which now sit in museums in Russia. And most importantly, he believed according to a close friend of his, again, the lady-in-waiting to his wife, Anna Virubova, and I quote from her memoirs of these times, he believed that it was possible outside the church and without the aid of regularly ordained bishops and priests to hold communion with God and his spirit. In other words, this was a very personal faith, not a narrowly orthodox one, but it was a very mystical faith, not like Tolstoy's, not a rationalist faith. Their famous, this is to say Nicholas and Alexandra's famous and notorious attraction to Grigory Rasputin was connected to this faith. By the way, Rasputin's actual name, his real family name, was Novik. Rasputin was a name, a nickname that he was widely given for his moral behavior. Rasputin is a word that means, or comes from the Russian word meaning debauched. And needless to say, Nicholas and Alexandra never called him by such a name. They only called him Grigory or Grishka, or most commonly, our friend. Nicholas Alexander believed, as did many Russians, that there were holy men to whom God gave mystical powers of healing and prophecy, people who could also hear God's voice. And it's worth saying that Rasputin was not the first to be seen by Nicholas and Alexander able to do this. During 1902 and 1903, Nicholas and Alexandra welcomed into their court a French mystic, a Catholic, after all, a man named Philippe, who was seen as a type of holy man who could hear God's word. And later, starting in 1905, especially when the hemophilia of the heir to the throne, Alexei, was becoming a source of great anxiety, Rasputin, a lay mystic and known to be a great healer, from Siberia originally, was invited to come to the palace and treat the son, and increasingly became a close part of court life, an advisor in so many ways. Now, all these stories about Nicholas as man and ruler, except perhaps stories about Rasputin, might seem really quite admirable in some ways, even charming, part of the romance that has often been described of the last imperial family. But these characteristics were also in many ways part of the story of the fall of the Romanov dynasty, of the rule of Nicholas II. There are, of course, many reasons that the Tsarist order was overthrown in 1917, some of which I'll be talking about more in the next couple of lectures. Not least, of course, was the devastating war with Germany and Austria. No less important, as we'll see, were the growing desires in society, which we've seen so much of, for democratic change and social reform. But essential, I think, to the reason that all of this change and threats led to the violent revolution that would occur in 1917 is that Russia's ruler, with all his personal power, found, in his words, so much pleasure and comfort in this very ancient political ideal. As you know, so much is changing in Russia and the world. Growing urbanization, growing education, a growing civil society, and of course, growing numbers of Russians talking about new political relationships, civil rights, democratic participation, rule of law. Yet the autocracy was retreating increasingly, though begun clearly with Nicholas's father, retreating into a stubborn, and many Russians at the time would say blind, faith in Russia's most ancient political tradition. The idea of the Tsar as absolute and mighty and all-powerful, divinely appointed and inspired and bound to his people, as Nicholas certainly believed, in a sort of mystical understanding and love, not bound to his nation or his people through democratic, law-based institutions. There's one other aspect of Nicholas's intellectual personality that deserves mention, for it was no less critical to understanding how he behaved and indeed why he fell from power in 1917. And I have in mind here Nicholas's deep fatalism, often noticed by people who knew him. Ultimately, Nicholas was certain that everything that happened in life was God's will. Whatever trials he or Russia as a whole had to experience were to be accepted with humility and grace. As he liked to say, God knows what's good for us. We must bow down our heads and repeat the sacred words, thy will be done. And this, in fact, was a leitmotif throughout his life. When Nicholas took the throne, which he did not desire, it's clear, but accepted as part of duty and fate, in the face of a disaster that occurred during celebrations of his coronation in Moscow in 1896, when 1,000 people were trampled to death trying to push up to the souvenir stands where beer and souvenir cups were available. His response to this disaster that opened his reign, 1,000 killed, 1,000 people probably killed, his answer was simple. It's God's will. In fact, most notoriously, he was invited to go to a dance at the embassy of the French, at the French ambassador's residence. His advisor said, you shouldn't do this. It's an embarrassing thing to do after this terrible disaster on your coronation day. He said, it's God's will. During the revolutionary upheavals of 1905, which I'll talk about next time, when he agreed to allow democratic elections for a legislature, to allow a measure of civil rights, again, he said, it's God's will. Though to be sure, he tries to undo some of these changes, having become convinced that he misunderstood God's will on that occasion. And most importantly, in 1917, when he was forced from the throne, held prisoner of the new democratic government and then of the Bolsheviks, when Romanov rule had finally ended, again his answer was the same. It's God's will. Now, for some people who have looked at Nicholas's life and behavior and his personality, this sort of stoic fatalism is what earned him sainthood. And as you may know, the Orthodox Church has recently canonized Nicholas and his family and many others who died at the hands of communists. And in particular, they sanctified Nicholas II as a special type of saint that was called a passion sufferer, precisely for his acceptance of God's fate, no matter how horrible. For other observers, though, of Nicholas II, this fatalism was one of the many tragic flaws that led to his fall and even to his death, along with this archaic, this faith and this archaic, and many would say no longer viable political ideal. If he was less fatalistic, and of course capable of understanding more political alternatives, it said he might have been willing to carry through on the type of reforms that at least one point in his reign in 1905 he began. For fairness, though, we should keep in mind the illusions and, one might say, the blinding faith that existed on the other side. The Bolsheviks and their supporters who made the revolution of 1917, at least its latter part, who executed the Romanovs in the summer of 1918, they too had their own utopian ideas. They too, as you'll see, had their own faith in the people and the special relationship between, in this case, not czar, but party and people. They too had a faith that history was certainly on their side. But that's another story, which we'll return to soon. First, though, it's necessary to follow Nicholas and his government as they faced an earlier challenge, really the greatest political challenge yet faced by the autocracy, the revolution of 1905.
Lecture 20, The Revolution of 1905.
This lecture looks at really what was at this point the greatest political challenge the modern Russian autocracy had faced, a massive social and political revolution in the year 1905. Before looking at this event, though, one needs to consider again the continued growth in Russia of opposition to traditional autocracy, because this is what the movement grew out of. And of particular importance here is the steady rise of liberalism in the years since the turn of the century. Liberal ideas, of course, as we've seen, have had a long history in Russia, going back well into the late 18th century. Among professionals and many educated nobles, by the 19th century, such ideas had really become quite commonplace. What was new in the 20th century, though, was the extent of organization among people with liberal, as opposed to radical socialist, ideas. And a high point in this organization of liberals came in 1904, when a whole variety of societies of liberals that had been formed around the country united to form a political party, necessarily at this point an illegal a political party that they called the Union of Liberation, to really fight for democratic liberal change in Russia. Now, there's lots of differences among individuals who were part of this liberal movement, but most of them pretty much agreed on a common program. Extension of basic civil rights to all Russians, freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, assembly, and the like. They believed deeply in the rule of law that should trump the absolute power, the personal power, the will of autocrats, of bureaucrats, of police. What they idealized was what had been called since the 19th century, using the German word, a Rechtsstaat, a society based on the rule of law, but in fact they were more likely to talk about it simply as a society based on a constitution, what of course Nicholas II condemned as senseless dreams. They believed in what they like to call four-tailed suffrage, suffrage that was universal, everybody should have a right to vote, equal, wasn't weighted in favor of some class over another, direct, there wasn't a series of stages, and secret, so no one would know what personal choice you made. I should note that this idea of universal suffrage was for many only universal male suffrage, though even and increasingly many liberals believed, in fact, women should be allowed to vote as well. But they debated it. They also believed, of course, in a democratically elected parliamentary government. Now, in fact, they disagreed, liberals among themselves, over whether this was necessary yet to be legislative. Some believed it would be all right for a period of time to have a consultative body, though that required the Tsar and his ministers to consult, really, with these elected representatives and take their advice seriously. Though it's worth saying that by 1904, really only a minority of liberals thought that a consultative assembly was good enough. It was time, partly because they didn't trust the monarchy, it was time to have real legislative power. Liberals also believed in strong local self-government. They believed the zemstvos were powerful and should even be stronger controlling local affairs. The zemstvos, of course, being these councils of rural self-government set up in the great reforms. And they believed the same about city councils that really should run the cities. They believed in education very deeply. They believed that one of Russia's problems, its backwardness, could be corrected by widespread education that would teach people civic values, teach them how to be citizens in a liberal society. And they believed, therefore, the state should provide free education. And they believed also in the importance of social reforms. They talked about the necessity of land reform in Russia, distributing lands belonging to the state, or the state buying private lands and selling them to the peasants who did not have enough land to survive. They also believed in labor legislation. They believed unions should be legal. Strikes should be legal. The state should legislate an eight-hour day, social insurance, that government should set up arbitration boards to negotiate and improve conditions for workers. It's important that these Russian liberals were not pure laissez-faire liberals in their outlook. Very much in the Russian tradition, they believed that people who were educated needed to be concerned with the welfare of the people, and they believed that the state had an important role to improve people's conditions. Now, as we've seen, socialists also were becoming more organized in the late 19th, early 20th century. We've already discussed the growth of the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, starting in the 1890s, and the division of the party in 1903 into Bolsheviks and Mensheviks, but there was also the rise of a new major populist socialist party organized in 1901 and called the Socialist Revolutionary Party, or simply the SR Party. Like populists before them, this party had two faces in its strategy and its approach to political action. First of all, it believed deeply in education and in organization, that it tried to promote its program through institutions that would educate people to think about socialist ideas through what they like to call propaganda.